Hi, it's Diane. On my mind, reflecting on America's democracy is 4th of July. 6 years ago, Danielle Allen came on my show to discuss her book, Our Declaration. It's about why she thinks the text says as much about equality as it does about independence. We often rebroadcast that interview on the 4th, but this year there seems so much more to say. We decided to ask Danielle Allen to come back on to talk about America's response to the pandemic and the fragile state of our democracy. Allen is director of the Edmund J. Safra Center for Ethics at Harvard University. She spearheads Harvard's COVID-19 response initiative, which has published the Roadmap to Pandemic Resilience about reopening the U.S. economy. Danielle, I want to briefly revisit our 2014 discussion about your book, Our Declaration. You made the argument that the document is about equality as much as it is independence. Now, as we near the 4th of July, explain that idea to us.
In the 18th century, when people were conceiving of self-government and new institutions for a constitutional democracy, they very often referred to what they were building as something for free and equal self-governing citizens. Freedom and equality went together. In other words, you were free when you had equal standing to participate in politics. That's the sense in which freedom and equality go together. So it really is about political equality in the first instance. And I think that's where the confusion has come in. To understand how freedom and equality belong together, you have to focus on the meaning of political equality specifically.
And Americans now, if not before, are so aware of Black inequality, with police violence, with how the whole community has been impacted by the COVID virus. How does the text offer lessons for this moment?
The connection between the Declaration and the current moment is truly extraordinary. People often forget how much the American Revolution was kicked off by arbitrary use of police power. In Massachusetts, one of the spark points were the writs of assistance, which gave customs officers the power to just search at will without any kind of cause whatsoever. So it's sort of stop and frisk of the colonial era in a sense. So the American revolutionaries were deeply resentful of abusive and excessive policing powers. And that shows up in the Declaration in the list of grievances when they complain about the way customs officers are acting, when they complain about what it means to have troops quartered in their houses and things like that.
And what about Black men and Black women who say, this text is not for me, it was written by men, white men who own slaves?
So, you know, Diane, we really actually have a misconception about who wrote the Declaration and how, and what the relation was between the Declaration and abolition. So let me actually tell a full story. So it's really important that the Declaration was written by a committee. Thomas Jefferson was just a scribe. When he put on his tombstone, author, Declaration of Independence, he was overclaiming. The intellectual architects of the Declaration were just as much John Adams from Massachusetts, who never was an enslaver, and Benjamin Franklin from Pennsylvania, who had enslaved people earlier in his life, but repudiated enslavement and became an active abolitionist. The language in the Declaration about life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness was really carefully crafted to actually make space for the anti-slavery position. By this point in the politics of the day, in the spring of 1776, the phrase rights of property were being used to defend enslavement. So when they came to debate the Declaration, one common formulation was that they should defend their rights of life, liberty, and property. And the fact that property didn't land in the Declaration there, instead we got life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, was a moment, an anti-slavery moment in the Declaration. People recognized this immediately. So in Boston, Prince Hall, a free African-American, picked up on the language of the Declaration right away, and by January of 1777, had submitted a petition to the Massachusetts Assembly to end enslavement in Massachusetts, and he drew on the language of the Declaration. So abolitionism crystallized around the language of the Declaration quite quickly, and indeed, slavery was ended in Massachusetts and Pennsylvania by the early 1780s. So we so associate the Declaration with Thomas Jefferson that we mistakenly associate it with enslavement. In fact, it was owned just as much by abolitionists, and it's abolitionists who made use of the text immediately for a political gain.
How do your students today react to the Declaration?
Well, I always find it is a text that connects very profoundly to people, and for a basic human reason. Every single one of us is trying to make tomorrow better than yesterday. Every single one of us is looking around our world and figuring out, why are things not working? How can I make them better? That's the basic structure of the Declaration. They diagnose their circumstances when they say when in the course of human events. They have a list of what's wrong with current human events. And they have a proposal for an improvement. They'd like to build a democracy for free and equal self-governing citizens. And when I work with students now, I find that they're very good at diagnosing problems around them. They see political institutions as non-responsive. They feel disempowered or alienated from institutions. And so they're looking for solutions to address those things. I was struck actually reading Benjamin Crump's recent book. He's the layawyer who represented Trayvon Martin's family, Michael Brown's family. He's represented a number of families whose young people have been victims of police killings. His conclusion digs deep into the language of the Declaration of Independence. He fully recognizes its power to speak to a deep human need for transformation and to the kind of resources of community we have to draw on to achieve transformation.
So do you see that the protests going on today all over the country as representative of what these young and older people believe the Declaration stands for?
Well, I do think there are people who are drawing on the Declaration now to articulate the view, as the Declaration puts it, that the job of our political institutions is to secure rights. And when our political institutions are not securing rights, then it's our job to alter them so that we can achieve that. So I do think since we last talked, Diane, I think it was 6 years ago, I had the pleasure of joining you on your show. I've been really encouraged to see more awareness of the Declaration of Independence, more awareness of its richness as a statement about human rights, about basic human equality. Of course, there are the limitations of the time of the period and the fundamental mistakes and crimes that were committed in the 1700s and 1800s. Nonetheless, I do think there is greater recognition of the power of the text, and it's helping people formulate a story of empowerment, a story of agency as they try to bring change in current circumstances.
And what might that mean toward change in how we view the police, how their role in society may need to change?
Well, I think a first thing that we need to do is shift our focus from the phrase and concept of criminal justice to the phrase administration of justice. That is, the entire point of political institutions is to administer justice. And by administering justice, we deliver safety and happiness to the whole people. Again, that's the language of the Declaration of Independence. So justice isn't about labeling a set of people as criminal or directly focusing exclusively on criminality. Justice is a bigger concept than that. And we would do a better job of delivering well-being to our society if we focused on the questions of health and public safety and well-being and flourishing for communities that are the fundamental questions.
Tell me your view of social media and the role it plays in helping us widen and broaden the understanding of the freedoms we have or should have.
Well, being part of a massive constitutional democracy requires a real exercise in imagination. Here we are, 330 million people. And somehow we're all supposed to be connected with each other. Somehow we are supposed to be governing together with one another. Somehow we're supposed to find a common purpose that unites us. How on earth do we do that given the magnitude of our society? I do think that media, visual media in particular, help people make those connections to others who are situated very differently, live in different places and positions. That was true in the civil rights movement as well, where photography made a huge difference for bringing the experiences of African Americans into visibility for the entire country. The same thing is true now. I mean, I think we have all been united in the terror of watching people die on video. I mean, it's a terrible, terrible thing to experience collectively over and over again. A terrible thing, obviously, even more so for Mr. Floyd, for his family. But it does mean that we have to see together that this is part of our common life, that it's something that we share and that we are obliged to reckon with together.
Something else that's happened and certainly is in relation to your current work. What has the pandemic, COVID-19, shown us about American democracy?
I think that we've faced real challenges with COVID-19. The disease was, you know, incredibly infectious, very powerful, a real surprise to us. It did, when it arrived, constitute an existential threat. You know, it was real vulnerability for our health system, real vulnerability, obviously, for our economy. And so I think in a moment of existential threat, a society really reveals what its core values are. And I have to say, I'm not so sure we really passed the test as well as we might have. So I was quite personally shocked at the beginning of the response by how quickly people moved into a vocabulary of, well, maybe if people are over a certain age, we won't worry about it. It's, you know, it's not our job to protect them. Or maybe we should just let all the young people get it and sort of not really worry about that. So there was a sort of starting view that it was okay to imagine abandoning parts of our society. From my point of view, that's a failure. From my point of view, a healthy social compact begins from the proposition that we do not abandon anybody, that our first job is to figure out how to deliver safety and happiness, again, the words of the Declaration of Independence, to everybody. So we've discovered that our social compact's not healthy. That discovery was reinforced as we looked at the issue of health inequities and disparities that mean that the fatality rate is so much higher for members of minority populations than for others. But I think seeing so clearly the way in which our social compact is broken or not as strong as it should be is a real motivation to repair. So my hope is that what we're seeing around us now, the energies that come from recognizing the need to rebuild a healthy social compact.
Do you think we're capable of doing that?
I do think we are. I mean, people sort of always ask me, well, Danielle, are you an optimist? Or Danielle, are you a pessimist? And what I always say is that failure is not an option. So I'm not an optionist. So I do. And I mean, I've been lucky in other work. I recently chaired an American Academy of Arts and Sciences commission on the practice of democratic citizenship. And we were able to hold listening sessions all over the country to talk about people's experiences of this democracy. And I found deep wells of resilience and commitment of Americans to the country as a whole and to one another. So I have lots of reasons for hope and belief in us as a people.
There's been this idea floated that because of our federalist system, we've had a harder time managing this pandemic. Do you believe that's true?
I do not. I think our federalist structure is an asset, not a liability. Germany also has a federal structure. They made theirs work effectively. We have this beautiful machinery with these different jurisdictions, national, state level, municipal, county, and so forth. And in the ideal, they harmonize the vocabulary from the Federalist Papers. So federalism isn't about leaving states to do things by themselves. Federalism is about making sure that every layer of our jurisdictions knows precisely what its role is, so that the whole thing can harmonize together and pull together. So our machinery is incredible. It provides flexibility. It provides the capacity to differentiate responses for different districts. What we're missing is knowledge of how to use our machinery. That's our problem. So, no, I think there was plenty of room for success with our federal infrastructure.
You're saying that governance itself was the problem, not the system.
Exactly. Governance is the problem. So again, I really like to invoke the vocabulary of the Federalist Papers, where they make the case that federalism is about harmonizing the interests of the state. So the national government has a responsibility in relationship to federalism, and it is this responsibility of federalism. So that means you have to know how to do the work of establishing a common purpose that can be shared across all the different levels of our government. You have to know how to do the work of helping each layer understand its role and how they connect. So the national government needed to provide the sort of economic bedrock for a successful COVID response. It really needed to secure supply chains in effective ways, for example. The state governments have really had the jobs of building the boots on the ground personnel that are going to respond through contact tracing and the like to COVID. City and county officials needed to collaborate with each other. County health officials have the health expertise, but they don't have the person power. City governments have the people, they have the legal administration and staff, they have all the infrastructure, so they needed to collaborate. So it's really that, you know, setting common purpose, clarity of roles, and making sure that the structures of collaboration are in place to activate all those roles. That's the governance piece. That's where we fell short.
So you're talking about layers of the structure of government. What about those who are not part of government? Do we really sufficiently understand our roles as citizens of this country in a pandemic such as this?
Well, I think that's a great question. And so when I'm laying out the roles that are held by people at different levels, there's a role for ordinary people too. So every single one of us can help. We can do our own do-it-yourself contact tracing. If we know that we've been exposed, we can alert people that we may have exposed them, for example, to the disease. We can participate in masking and social distancing. But it's also really important that there's a consistent national message all the way through about what our overarching goal is, what our overarching purpose is. Our purpose should have been, from the get-go, disease suppression, getting back to near zero case incidents. We never had that articulated as a national goal. To some extent, we sort of, in a de facto way, fell into mitigation, which is just slowing the spread. It's flattening the curve, but it's not completely breaking the chain of transmission. So we had confusion because we didn't actually know what our shared goal was. And therefore, it was very hard for people to give a clear definition to the role of ordinary people.
So we did hear from some of the doctors at the highest level, I think most of all from Dr. Anthony Fauci. And yet, that part of the message, beyond just what you can do to mitigate the spread, seems to have been lost. And we see people out on the street without masks. We see people congregating at bars. It's as though they're thinking, this virus is not going to touch me. I don't need to listen to anyone else in any authority.
I think we have a problem, honestly, in this country in terms of how we tap into expertise in political decision making. So Dr. Fauci had a whole heck of a lot of medical and public health expertise to share. He didn't, however, have any economic expertise. And at the end of the day, what we really needed was somebody who could present an integrated picture of how we align our health and our economic objectives. That integrated picture never emerged. And it really is the job of elected officials, elected leaders, to provide that integrated picture. So their job is to know what the question is that we need to ask. And the question we needed to ask was, how do we protect lives, liberties, and livelihoods simultaneously? Let's maximize alignment before we start looking at trade-offs. We jumped straight to thinking there were trade-offs. We never took the time to maximize alignment. And if we had done that, try to align a solution, again, to protect lives, liberties, and livelihoods simultaneously, we would have much more quickly seen how important testing and contact tracing are to achieving that alignment of our objectives. All right, but so we needed our elected leaders to be asking that question, asking for an integration of perspective. And then they integrate the perspective and they can say, well, here's what we're getting from our scientists and our doctors. Here's how we integrate that picture. Whereas Dr. Fauci was consistently giving us just one perspective, and it was never fully integrated with a whole picture, which is what made it easy for people to dismiss. They didn't hear Dr. Fauci an answer on the economic side, so they just dismissed him completely, right? So we didn't get to a place where we had a fully integrated answer.
So in a sense, you had some politicians offering the economic data, you had the medical scientists offering the health data, but you never heard from, except, I must say, Governor Cuomo did make an attempt to do exactly that, integrate the two.
I think where we see success, that's exactly what leaders did, was they integrated those two perspectives. Governor Cuomo succeeded. Governor Baker here in Massachusetts has succeeded in this way. And so I think we do see local successes. And what they do really underscore is how important the presidency is as a teaching platform. Governor Cuomo, Governor Baker, in their local jurisdictions have been able to be effective integrators and educators. We haven't had that same integration and education coming from the platform of the presidency.
More of my conversation with Danielle Allen when we come back.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
It's news,
culture, and curiosities.
From the District, Tacoma Park,
Alexandria,
Friendship Heights,
Hyattsville,
Falls Church,
Northeast Washington, D.C., in your inbox every weekday afternoon.
DCS Daily.
Sign up at dcs.com/newsletter.
dcs.com/newsletter.
Here's the rest of my conversation with Danielle Allen. She's director of the Edmund J. Safra Center for Ethics at Harvard University. You know, I'm really struck by the fact that when I was in high school, which was a very long time ago, we had government classes. We had civics classes. So much of that has been lost, which taught me at the time what my responsibility as a citizen was, not only in regard to voting for who those people up on Capitol Hill or in the White House or in the governor's mansion would be, but also what my responsibilities as a citizen were. I think we've lost that. Those classes have been eliminated practically across the country.
There's been great loss without any question. You can capture it in a number of ways. So, for example, the federal investment, annual investment in STEM education is $54 per student, whereas the federal investment in social studies or civics education is 5 cents per student. And I do think you get what you pay for. We are not investing in civic education, in government, in social studies, and we are watching an erosion of our collective capacity to understand our institutions, to understand effective governance, and to be able to lead on the basis of those bodies of knowledge and understanding.
So if that education were there, what kind of civic participation might we have seen in regard to this COVID virus, in regard to all of the issues, police activity, education, what might we have seen?
Well, let me tell you actually about some positive things we have seen that I hope that we could see more broadly. So a couple of different success stories, one from New Orleans, another from a mayor. In New Orleans, the city actually had success suppressing COVID pretty rapidly in April. And it's huge spike up, and then they brought it down really fast. And one of the things that made that possible actually was learning from Hurricane Katrina. Hurricane Katrina left them in a place where their different jurisdictions, their health offices and their mayoral offices and so forth, were already used to collaborating. They were already used to identifying a shared strategic goal or objective, and then driving that goal through the whole of their community. So it worked. And that was governance, you know, in a beautiful, beautiful way. And so that's what we really would love to see across our whole system. That means rebuilding that ability to collaborate. It means rebuilding that ability to find that shared objective, that first question, and then to be able to drive that understanding of common purpose all the way through a set of jurisdictions. I was also lucky to speak to a mayor recently who told me that she's used this moment to open up town halls around the theme of what a new social compact in her city should be. So she's asking her community to go back to first principles and to articulate what their common goals are. And as she's doing that, she has all of her different kind of experts from her different agencies in the room together. And so they're obliged to integrate their expertise. So when policing comes up, for example, there's questions of policing that pertain to budgets. There's questions of policing that pertain to health. There's questions of policing that pertain to recruitment and training and education and so forth. These expertise silos often live separately from one another. They don't always get pulled into a joint conversation. So she's helping people go back to first principles. What's a healthy social compact? And she's making sure that a diversity of kinds of expertise are in the room together to hear the community talk about that and then to deliver their knowledge and expertise to try to answer the questions the community is putting on the table.
Of course, that could be applied to small companies, large corporations.
Everywhere.
Everywhere.
Exactly. Exactly. It's just that basically asking the question, what would a healthy social compact look like? How can we get experts in the room who don't normally talk to each other so they're all in the same conversation? How can we make sure that we're hearing from the community about diagnosis of problems to set the agenda as experts get to work?
Now, that word experts, that's where we seem to run into problems regarding the issue of white supremacy that goes all the way back to the Declaration and that lingers even today. There is this feeling, and with good reason, that white Americans rule the country, rule the corporations, rule the networks, rule the universities. How do you speak to those people who feel that white supremacy still rules this country?
Well, I mean, I think I separate out different kinds of things. So I think that we do need diversification across our institutions. I think that there are two different questions. There's a question of who's in the room, who's participating, who has opportunities. That's one question. And then there's a question of sort of once people are in the room, how do they interact with each other? Do they interact with each other in ways that are actually egalitarian and power sharing? Or do they interact based on patterns of domination, say white domination of other people? It's the latter thing that I associate with the concept of white supremacy in particular. So how does one change habits of expectation that some people have authority and other people defer and have to exhibit deference? We have a lot of work to do in some of our basic cultural habits. With regard to diversifying organizations, without any question, there's still lots of work to do. I mean, there is also considerable progress, right? I mean, I sort of sit here and speak to you as a faculty member at Harvard, and I am lucky to have a wonderful, rich array of colleagues, other African-Americans and so forth across fields. I think a thing that is of concern to me is that we haven't seen diversification equally across all fields. So economics, for example, is a field that is not super diverse. As I've been doing work on COVID and interacting in public health spaces, I've seen many fewer African-American faces alongside me in meetings than I would have hoped to have seen. So I do think we need expertise is an anchor, without any question, for flourishing across any number of dimensions. And so being able to integrate expertise is a fundamental need.
What about media?
Absolutely. I mean, I know there's been a lot of discussion and, you know, contentious conversations in newsrooms over the last few months. And old habits die hard. So, I mean, I do think that, there are many, many people have been doing a lot of well-intentioned work around diversity and diversification for decades. It goes in phases. So in the 50s and 60s, we were doing a lot of work on rebuilding formal rights. You know, we passed the Voting Rights Act. We passed the Civil Rights Act. So what we're seeing now is we have to see that the country has both a political constitution and a social constitution. And the political constitution is what's captured by things like the Voting Rights Act and the Civil Rights Act, where we can change formal structures. But the social constitution is what is constituted out of our habits. And again, it's sort of what are our patterns of who defers to whom and why do we have expectations around that? And those are habits we have to bring to the surface and be explicit about and reorganize. We need to change them. They need to go. So that does mean lifting up the voices of people of color, of people who have been in disadvantaged positions or expected to be silent in meetings, for example. It means anytime you are organizing a conference or a work project, make sure you have a diverse team assigned to it. If you do that over and over and over again, A, it gets easier. B, you start revving up the engines of recruitment because you start putting out the word that you're looking for people, and then people get the word that there are opportunities that they didn't know about, and so forth. So you have to really build in new practices of diversifying teams, lifting up the voices of people who've traditionally been asked to be silent or to sit in the corners of meetings and so forth.
So you're saying basically that we need a new social compact.
I am saying that we need a new social compact. That doesn't mean throwing out everything that we've had. It means sorting out the bad from the good, building on the good, and being innovative and creative where we have to replace the bad.
You've talked about the kind of reforms we need as to how we vote. Can you talk about those?
Sure. So the American Academy of Arts and Sciences released a report called Our Common Purpose in early June. And we've got 31 recommendations for reform, some on political institutions, some on our civil society, private organizations, and some in our civic culture. But on voting specifically, we are arguing that voting should be a matter of voter duty, just like jury duty. It should be mandatory. And we should celebrate our duty and responsibility in relationship to it by making the Federal Election Day a national holiday. Ideally, Veterans Day could become our Federal Election Day. Then people would have a day off, a paid day off, when on the day they go to the polls. We could build rituals recognizing and celebrating service to this country, whether in the military or in the form of voter duty, say, or jury duty. At the same time that we think voting should be mandatory, we think voting should also be easy. If it's going to be mandatory, it needs to be easy. So we also recommend, for example, automatic voter registration. We think that's a really important part of a successful voting structure.
And what about mail-in voting?
For November, for this election, we do recommend mail-in voting. In our package of recommendations, we recommend mail-in voting now as a part of emergency response to COVID. We don't make it a long-term recommendation. Our focus is on expanding the number of voting sites, automatic voter registration, and mandatory voting.
The president has maintained all along that mail-in voting creates a greater threat to fraud and that it can't be trusted. What are your thoughts on that?
For mail-in voting to work effectively, you do have to ask Secretary of State's offices to do work cleaning up voting rolls. So there is work to be done to ensure that mail-in voting can be legitimate and successful. That work is doable and it should be done. Given the pandemic conditions, that work is really urgent. So the president is wrong to cast it as a global issue that mail-in voting is somehow just as such problematic. The right way of understanding the situation is to recognize that successful mail-in voting does require secretaries of state to have clean voting rolls. And the states are in varying places with that element. So there is work to be done, but it's achievable.
I want to also ask you about the work you've done on the COVID crisis and the new COVID map that you've helped to create.
So much about successful democracy depends on clarity of purpose, clarity of objective. And in the COVID crisis, we have had such a hard time achieving a national unified message of what we're trying to do. So my research network at Harvard collaborated with several other groups at Harvard, as well as with public health centers and policy centers all over the country to articulate a shared objective and provide a metrics structure to support that. So the shared objective that we've articulated is that our goal should be suppression. It should be to get back to near zero case incidents. And in order to track our progress in relationship to that goal, we need to be able to map the country in relationship to levels of case incidents. So we've launched a map, launched it this morning. You can find it on the Harvard Global Health Institute website. that on a county by county basis tells you whether you're at green, yellow, orange, or red risk level with regard to COVID. So green is less than one new daily case on a rolling average, yellow 1 to 10, orange 10 to 25, red over 25 new daily cases per 100,000 people. So that makes it possible to compare across the country. It makes it possible to see who is getting back to green, so to speak, who's on that path to zero case incidence. And we hope that this will be a tool that helps decision makers be more strategic in implementing their COVID responses.
So it was unveiled this morning. You and I are speaking on Wednesday morning. How widely do you think that kind of viewing is going to be utilized?
Well, I'm delighted to say that the U.S. Conference of Mayors yesterday endorsed this approach, endorsed a strategy of suppression, and endorsed the sort of local jurisdiction perspective that we brought to bear. So we hope there will be broad uptake and dissemination through their network. I think it's gotten enough uptake through Twitter releases and so forth that the website is crashing. So that's not good. We should be crashing. So we're on that. We're making sure that's fixed, but it does suggest there's good traffic already.
Danielle, I want to ask you, I know that many people feel our democracy has begun to fail. Do you believe there's any truth to that?
I do think our democracy, our constitutional democracy, is in a weakened state. I don't think it's begun to fail. That's where I come back to the resilience I have seen in communities all over this country, the commitment Americans articulate to one another and to our constitutional democracy, and to the love of country that I have seen everywhere. Americans have different ways of expressing their love of country, but all across this country, all backgrounds, all socioeconomic levels, all ethnic backgrounds, all religious backgrounds, people articulate a love of country. As long as we have that and can combine that with our traditional creativity and can-do spirit, I have 100% confidence that we can fix where we are failing, rebuild our strength, rebuild our civic strength, and achieve common purpose.
You have a Congress that's not working with each other. You have a White House working with only one party in this democracy. With that as the stage on which this democracy currently stands, how can you have confidence?
Again, at the end of the day, I think every constitutional democracy rests on the people. It's by the people, for the people, of the people, or of the people, by the people, for the people. You could put it in almost any order. And so as long as the people has what it takes to rebuild a constitutional democracy, we're okay. We do need to rebuild civic education. We do need to rebuild our ability to connect with each other across partisan lines. There's work that we as a people need to do to repair ourselves. But I do believe we have the capacity for that. And as I said, I see people bringing change all over the country. I admire a group in Lexington, Kentucky called Civic Lex that has re-envisioned how media can support healthy political dialogue in a given city, for example. I have watched people in Spokane, Washington, repurpose abandoned buildings as community centers and connect faith leaders with leaders of secular service organizations to strengthen ties in a community. I am watching people move ranked choice voting forward as a mechanism for transforming our electoral system. New York City is going to be using ranked choice voting. Maine is using ranked choice voting. Massachusetts is considering it. All over the country, we have watched individuals lead bipartisan efforts to achieve independent redistricting for congressional districting maps and so forth. So there is a story that is about renovation and transformation and reinvention that is occurring in parallel to the story that is about alienation and frustration and disappointment. So I say, affirm the positive, let's find it, let's shine a light on it, let's lead by example, and I believe the examples are there.
Danielle, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Diane. It's a pleasure to talk with you.
That was Danielle Allen, Director of the Edmund J. Safra Center for Ethics at Harvard University. And that's all for today. Thanks to those of you who've reached out to let me know what you'd like me to cover during this very difficult time. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter, or send us an email, drpodcast@wamu.org. Our theme music is composed by Jim Brunberg and Ben Landsberg of Wonderly. The show is produced by Rebecca Kaufman and Allison Brody. Our engineer is Mike Kidd. Thanks for listening, all. I hope you have a very safe and happy 4th of July. Stay safe. Stay well. I'm Diane Rehn.